This is the Voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran's broadcasting. The Voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran is broadcast daily via the internet address www.parstoday.com/en. You can also listen to the Voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran on Hotbird, Intelsat 902, and Eutelsat satellite, as well as via internet. You can also listen to IRIB English Radio via your mobile phone. Please refer to our website for more details.
Here, we enlighten you with the ayah 61 of Surah Yunus, recited by Ahmad Mirza Tawqifi.
A'udhu billahi minash shaitanir rajim. Bismillahir rahmanir rahim. Wa ma takunu fi sha'ni wa ma tatlu. وَمَا تَتْلُو مِنْهُ مِنْ قُرْآنٍ وَلَا تَعْمَلُونَ مِنْ عَمَلٍ إِلَّا كُنَّا عَلَيْكُمْ شُهُودًا وَمَا يَعْزُبُ عَنْ رَبِّكَ مِنْ مِثْقَالِ ذَرَّةٍ فِي الْأَرْضِ وَمَا يَعْزُبُ عَنْ رَبِّكَ مِنْ مِثْقَالِ ذَرَّةٍ فِي الْأَرْضِ وَلَا السماء ولا أصغر من ذلك ولا أصغر من ذلك ولا أكبر إلا في كتاب وما يعزب عن ربك من مثقال ذرة في الأرض ولا في السماء ولا أصغر من ذلك ولا أصغر من ذلك ولا أكبر إلا في كتاب مبين صدق الله العلي العظيم.
In the name of God, the most gracious, the most compassionate. And you are not engaged in any affair, nor do you recite concerning it any portion of the Qur'an, nor do you do any work, but we are witnesses over you when you enter into it. And there does not lie concealed from your Lord the weight of an atom in the earth, or in the heaven, nor anything less than that, nor greater, but it is in a clear book. Thank you.
This is IRIB English Radio. Coming up is the news.
Yemen launches a drone strike on Tel Aviv, leaving one person dead and several others injured. At least 50 Palestinians are killed in latest Israeli airstrikes across Gaza, where the total death toll is now approaching 38,850. And Palestinian health officials sound the alarm over a polio epidemic in Gaza after wastewater treatment stations shut down due to a lack of fuel. Now, Yemeni armed forces say they've carried out a drone strike on Tel Aviv in retaliation for Israeli massacres against Palestinians in Gaza. Have a listen.
The UAV force of the Yemeni armed forces, with the help of Allah Almighty, carried out a specific military operation which consisted of targeting one of the important targets in the occupied Jaffa region, what is now called Israeli Tel Aviv. The operation was carried out with a new drone called Yaffa, which is capable of bypassing the enemy's interception system and undetectable by radars. The operation has achieved its goal successfully.
In a statement, Saadi also said Tel Aviv will remain a primary target for the Yemeni armed forces. He added that Yemen will continue to strike positions in Israel, including sensitive military and intelligence targets. Saadi also vowed Yemen's anti-Israel operations will continue as long as the Gaza genocide and the regime siege on the Palestinian territory continue. At least one person was killed and several others injured in the drone attack in Tel Aviv. Drone hit an area near the U.S. consulate office, causing damage to it. Tel Aviv's mayor says the city is now moving to a higher state of alert. Israeli media, meanwhile, says the regime's air defenses failed to detect the drone as no air raid sirens went off before the explosion took place. Joining us now from the Yemeni capital, Sana'a, is Abdul Latif Al-Washali for more on the story. Hello, Abdul Latif. Good morning. Hope you're doing well out there in Sana'a. What can you tell? This is an unprecedented attack, serious sophistication, which eluded all Israeli sirens and air defenses, Abdul Latif.
Thank you so much. You know, the Yemeni army has once again proved to the entire world the ineffectiveness of the Western weaponry, and that the warnings of the Yemeni army, the warnings of the leader of Ansarullah movement, Abdul Malik al-Houthi, were not mere media propaganda. They were real, and they, the Israeli regime, the U.S., the Britain, they should take these the warnings of the Yemeni army more seriously. The Yemeni attack today was used or utilized by a Yemeni drone, which was developed domestically, and it has managed to evade the enemy interception systems. So Yemenis here today are very happy to see the Yemeni army now attacking the Israeli enemy directly. The Yemenis are now expecting, you know, an attack from the Israeli regime, from the U.S., you know, airstrikes against the capital, Sana'a. They are well prepared. They have no problem. The entire the Yemeni people today, you know, it's a Friday today, so the Yemenis are going to take to the streets, you know, to keep supporting the Palestinian people and also to endorse the naval operations of the Yemeni army. And today they're going to be celebrating the attack against Tel Aviv, against the Israeli enemy. People here are expecting, you know, more developments in the upcoming days. They wish to see the Yemeni army hitting further targets in the occupied territories, and I'm very sure that the Yemeni army is well prepared to escalate the attacks against the occupied territories. We believe that it's not going to attack only Yaffa, which is known as Tel Aviv, but also other occupied regions in the upcoming days, as long as they keep their daily crimes against the Palestinian people in Gaza. These attacks were prompted by the ongoing atrocities of the Israeli regime against the Palestinian people, and the Yemenis felt that they have to move for the Palestinian people.
Right, and Abdul Latif, I mean, we've seen a serious escalation, you know, with the dozens upon dozens of Israeli-linked vessels in the high seas, and now we're seeing the port of Haifa frequently hit, and not just the Yemenis, but Yemenis in conjunction with resistance factions out of Iraq are hitting Umm al-Rashrash, which is the Eilat port. They're hitting Haifa. Now they're hitting into Tel Aviv. Ansarullah leader Abdul Malik al-Houthi, he said that they're going to escalate, that if the Israelis continue killing civilians and continue depriving civilians in Gaza of food, medicine, and clean water, that they will increase attacks both in frequency, scope, and the caliber of these attacks. And we are seeing this. So basically, the Israelis don't seem like they're willing to accept a ceasefire. So is it safe to say that these Yemeni attacks will continue to increase in both scale and frequency?
Yes, you know, now it's their call now. The Yemeni army has repeatedly warned the Israeli regime from continuing to killing the Palestinian people. The Yemeni army will continue its naval operations, whether in the Red Sea. Now, you know, they have hit multiple targets in the Mediterranean Sea through multiple operations. So the Yemeni army has the capabilities to escalate its operations, you know, in coordination with the Islamic resistance in Iraq and other forces, other resistance forces in the region. So I believe that the operations will continue to escalate as long as the Israeli regime continues its crimes against the Palestinian people. The resistance forces in the region believe that it's now maybe the time to end the Israeli occupation, to liberate the Palestinian territories from the Israeli occupation. And maybe this is the chance for the Yemeni people to be a major part in this battle against the Israeli enemy, which is, you know, the enemy of the entire nation, the Islamic nation, the Arab people. The Yemeni people are supporting these operations, and we hope to see other resistance forces in the region collaborating with the Yemeni army in attacking the Israeli regime, in attacking Israeli bound ships, in besieging the Israeli ports. And, you know, the Yemeni army has the capabilities, and we hope to see other forces doing that with the Yemeni army.
Thank you, Abdul Latif. Stay safe. We'll talk to you soon. Abdul Latif al-Washali joining us from Sana'a. Meanwhile, Israel's indiscriminate strikes continue to pound Gaza, taking the lives of more women and children. In central Gaza, five members of a single family and two civilians were killed in airstrikes on the Al-Burej refugee camp. Four children are missing. Israeli forces also targeted a civilian vehicle in Deir al-Bala, killing three people. Meanwhile, an attack on a home in the Nusayrat camp killed one civilian and injured eight others. And in Gaza City, an Israeli airstrike killed at least five civilians. An earlier attack on Gaza City's Al-Falah school killed two people and injured five others. To the south, 12 bodies were recovered from a mass grave at Al-Amma Hospital in Khan Yunis. Now, Israeli strikes resulted in over 54 Palestinian deaths and 95 injuries in the past 24 hours, increasing the overall death toll from the regime's genocide to nearly 38,850, creeping up on 39,000 casualties since October the 7th. In Gaza, pain and suffering of those surviving Israeli attacks continue to grow, and among them, amputees whose catastrophic experiences have worsened due to the decimation of rehabilitation facilities. And now a young Palestinian physician in central Gaza is providing them with rehabilitation services in displacement camps. Our correspondent Gada Al-Zabut has your story.
In the middle of this genocidal war and the ongoing Israeli attacks on the Gaza Strip, suffering is increasingly unfolding. Today we are here to present the story of Mortaz Abudayya. Mortaz led an initiative to help the people around him who are struggling with the amputations they sustained by the Israeli attacks on the Gaza Strip. The initiative of this young physiotherapist relies heavily on his volunteer efforts to rehabilitate the amputated limb for the future journey of recovery. What makes this initiative particularly impactful is the deep sense of solidarity it fosters within the community. Mortaz does not only contribute his time and skills, but also provides emotional support to the recipients who are grappling with the trauma of losing a limb in a war zone.
Actually, this initiative is about providing the service of physiotherapy. According to the current circumstances in the Gaza Strip due to this genocidal war and the lack of resources and rehabilitation and physiotherapy centers, I chose to help the injured people with amputations in my area.
In the wake of the complete absence of rehabilitation centers in the Gaza Strip by the Israeli bombing, this man is in urgent need for help. He finds his relief in Mortaza's initiative. This man is trying to cope with the unbearable conditions of life after losing his home. He's also struggling to find water, food, and medications for him and for his family.
I lost both of my legs and my arm is fractured. It is hard for me to move and meet my family's needs, so I appeal to everyone in the world to support my right to a dignified life with my family. The initiative of Dr. Mortaza is very good for the injured people, in the displacement centers particularly.
As we have just seen, this story of suffering is one of thousands. A lot of Palestinians inside these evacuation camps are still suffering and struggling. However, the suffering is multiplied when the person is amputated. This initiative led by Mortaz is trying to reach for the global community and trying to raise awareness about the circumstances of the Palestinian amputated people. Ghada Zabut, the middle area of the Gaza Strip.
Palestinian health officials warn thousands of people in Gaza are at risk of contracting polio. Alarming revelation comes after a polio virus was detected in samples of sewage that is starting to take over Gaza amid ongoing Israeli onslaught. The Palestinian Health Ministry says thousands in crowded tents are now at risk of contracting this highly infectious disease, which causes deformities and paralysis. It added tests carried out in cooperation with the UN Children's Agency show presence of polio virus throughout Gaza. Ministry says sewage is flowing between tents used by tens of thousands of displaced Gazans and described presence of polio virus as a new and serious health disaster. Gaza officials said this week the wastewater treatment station has been turned off due to a lack of fuel. Doctors in Gaza say scabies, chickenpox, skin rashes, and lice are also spreading fast. UN agencies have frequently warned of risk of cholera and other more serious diseases becoming epidemics throughout Gaza. Thousands of pro-Palestinian protesters formed a human chain around British Parliament, calling on authorities to demand an immediate Gaza ceasefire and halt all arms sales to the Israeli regime and support efforts aimed at holding Israel accountable at international tribunals. Saeed Peruza has your details.
They've come out in their thousands, standing shoulder to shoulder in a line that snaked around the Parliament building as MPs sit for the first day of debate since the general election.
We've been calling for a ceasefire since October, and we're demanding a ceasefire, and it's many months down the line, and many thousands of people have been murdered.
It's the second protest since the Labour government swept to power in a general election earlier this month. An unbreakable human chain calling on Prime Minister Keir Starmer to pressure Israel to agree to a ceasefire and end its genocidal assault on Palestinians.
And for that to happen, this former Labour Party leader believes there are immediate measures the British government must take.
One, stop arms supplies to Israel. Two, demand a ceasefire. Three, stop the use of RAF Akrotiri to take material through. And four, demand the end of the occupation and abide by international law from the International Criminal Court and the International Court of Justice.
Despite his call for an immediate ceasefire, there was special fury here at new Foreign Minister David Lammy and his recent meeting with the Israeli Prime Minister. As of May this year, more than 70% of Britons want to see an end to the genocide in Gaza, and many back a pause in arms sales to Israel. There have been 9 months of protests demanding the UK government stop its complicity in genocide. That demand has gone unheeded so far. The question now is, how long can the new government ignore it? Saeed Peruza, London.
Pro-Palestinian activists in Italy have staged a demonstration against country's unconditional support for Israel's genocide. They gathered outside the Italian Foreign Ministry to voice anger at Foreign Minister Antonio Tajani for lying about Rome halting arms shipments to Israel. Here's a report.
A new pro-Palestine protest was staged in front of Italy's Ministry of Foreign Affairs on Thursday as the Palestinian death toll in Gaza nears 39,000. The initiative, organized by the Palestinian Students of Italy group, aimed to demand the Italian government halt its unconditional support and continued military aid to Israel. According to Gaza's Ministry of Health, more than 16,000 children have been slaughtered by the Tel Aviv regime so far. The photos of dozens of kids who have been brutally killed by the Israeli forces since October 7, 2023, were displayed during the protest.
Unfortunately, yet again, hypocrisy exceeds all bounds, both on the side of the EU and also on the side of Italy. Regrettably, Italian weapons continue to kill more children and civilians in Gaza, despite the false claims made by the Italian government.
Israel has also imposed a crippling blockade on the Gaza Strip, leaving its population on the verge of starvation and suffering from diseases brought about by the lack of fresh water and sanitation due to widespread bombing. According to a study published in the medical journal Lancet, the accumulative effects of Israel's brutal war on Gaza could mean the true death toll could exceed 186,000.
Italy's Deputy Prime Minister and Foreign Minister Antonio Tajani repeatedly said that Rome had stopped sending weapons to Israel as of October 7 last year. However, some Italian lawmakers have strongly challenged Tajani on this specific issue.
Minister Tajani has contradicted himself. Unfortunately, data from the Ministry of Foreign Affairs has shown that Italy has not stopped sending weapons to Israel at all.
Our organization has been calling for a ceasefire in Gaza for months. You think that arms company Leonardo, which is partially owned by the Italian Ministry of Economy, will ever stop selling weapons to Israel? Leonardo is only interested in making profits, even if this causes the death of thousands of children and civilians, and it is against our laws.
Italy, despite what its foreign minister says, is the world's third biggest exporter of arms to Israel. Max Civili, Rome.
That's a wrap for this. Thanks for tuning in, and bye-bye for now.
The whole world is silent towards oppression, even one voice becomes powerful. IRIB English Radio, the voice of the voiceless. Our internet address is parstoday.ir/en.
Supplication on Fridays. In the name of Allah, the All-Merciful, the All-Compassionate. Praise belongs to Allah, the first before the bringing forth and the giving of life, and the last after the annihilation of all things. The All-Knowing who forgets not him who remembers him, and decreases not him who thanks him, and disappoints not him who supplicates him, and cuts not off the hope of him who hopes in him. O Allah, I call thee to witness, and thou art sufficient witness, and I call to witness all thy angels, and the inhabitants of thy heavens and the bearers of thy throne, and thy prophets and thy messengers whom thou hast sent out, and the various kinds of creatures thou hast brought forth, that I bear witness that thou art Allah. There is no God but thou, thou alone, who hast no associate nor any equal, and thy word has no failing nor any change. And that Muhammad, Allah bless him and his household, is thy servant and thy messenger. He delivered to the servants that with which thou charged him, and he struggled for Allah as is his due. And he gave the good news of the truth of reward, and he warned of the veracity of punishment. O Allah, make me firm in thy religion as long as thou keepst me alive, and make not my heart to swerve after thou hast guided me, and give me mercy from thee. Surely thou art the giver. Bless Muhammad and the household of Muhammad, and make me one of his followers and his partisans, and muster me in his band, and give me the success of accomplishing the obligatory observance of Friday, and performing the acts of obedience which thou hast made incumbent upon me within it, and receiving the bestowal which thou hast apportioned for its people on the day of recompense. Thou, only thou, art the mighty wise.
In the limelight. Yemen security authorities are saying they have dismantled a large espionage network that was working for the United States and the Israeli regime. We take a look at the world media's coverage of this story. Please stay with us. Iran's Press TV has covered this story and tells us more. The Yemeni military announced recently that it had dismantled an American-Israeli espionage network operating within the Arab country, delivering a significant blow to attempts aimed at undermining the Yemeni government's institutions. According to a statement by the Yemeni military, the spies had proven and direct connections to the U.S. Central Intelligence Agency, CIA, as well as the Federal Bureau of Investigation, FBI, and the United States Agency for International Development, USAID. They also had connections to the Israeli spy agency, Mossad. The statement added, "The network was the main espionage arm of the United States and Israel, equipped with advanced technologies and devices to conduct its clandestine activities across various state institutions." Some members of the network had been collaborating with the CIA since the 1980s and the 1990s. The spies obtained highly sensitive information about Yemen's military, security, economic, agricultural, health, and educational sectors. They misused their roles at the U.S. Embassy in Sana'a to conduct their subversive activities. The statement said, after the U.S. Embassy left Sana'a in 2015, the spies pivoted to carry out their espionage activity under various pretexts in different fields, including agriculture and economy, using secret communication devices managed by U.S. officers.
Since 2015, the spies continued operating under the guise of international organizations, including various United Nations bodies. The statement also highlighted that the network's members had visited the United States several times to attend training workshops and meetings with American officials. This announcement follows the arrest of a group of 18 spies, known as Force 400, by Yemeni security authorities in the west of the country nearly 2 months ago. Major General Abdul Hakim Hashim al-Khaywani, head of Yemen's Security and Intelligence Service, stated in a televised address that the U.S.-Israeli-led espionage network had recruited officials within the Yemeni government to influence decision-makers and infiltrate state agencies. Major General al-Khaywani added that some of the network's operations had resulted in the spread of disease in Yemen, further damaging its already strained healthcare system due to years of Western sanctions. The network also promoted moral corruption to undermine Yemen's education system. According to Yemeni security agencies, the network executed American schemes to target the agriculture sector by producing and spreading agricultural pests, aiming to undermine local production and destroy the economy. The network recruited spies within the Ministry of Agriculture to sabotage agricultural research institutions and seed multiplication centers. It also recruited economists and owners of oil and commercial companies, linking them to American and Israeli spy services. The statement added, U.S.-Israeli espionage network has attracted many individuals and organized visits for them to the United States to influence and recruit them. The network influenced decision-makers, penetrated state authorities, and helped pass decisions and laws detrimental to Yemen. Unnamed sources claimed that American and Israeli spies attempted to kill some network members before their arrest to prevent information leakage. Major General al-Khaywani noted that the network provided intelligence to U.S. and Israeli militaries to aid in targeting Yemeni infrastructure used to attack Israeli and U.S.-linked ships in regional waters. The Yemeni military has recently escalated attacks on shipping in the Red Sea and also in the Gulf of Aden, Indian Ocean, and the Mediterranean Sea, demanding an end to Israel's brutal war in Gaza, which has resulted in nearly 38,000 Palestinians being killed since October of last year. In response, the United States and Britain deployed ships to the Red Sea to protect Israeli vessels and initiated a bombing campaign targeting various institutions in Yemen. Despite this, Yemeni forces announced recently that they would continue their military operations, expanding them to the Mediterranean Sea to lock Israel out of key waterways and impact its economy. The English website of Al Mayadeen television network has also covered the same story. Yemeni security forces released employment records of the network members linked to the U.S. spy services and embassy documents. Amer Abdelmajid al-Akbari was recruited by the CIA in 1987. He worked on projects to destroy soil, promote American products, reduce agricultural production, spread toxic pesticides, and transmit animal diseases. He also influenced the National Dialogue Conference in Yemen. Abdul Qadir Ali al-Saqaf, recruited in 1994, collected data on Yemen's political and judicial situation, supplying sensitive information about security and military operations to the CIA. Sharif Hifdhallah al-Hamdani, a CIA recruit since 1997, shared information on ballistic missile launch sites, drone operations, and military and economic targets. He also transmitted the central bank's code to fugitive authorities in Aden. Abdulmayin Hussein Aliazan had worked with the CIA and Mossad since 2006, providing information on Yemeni military manufacturing and strategic capabilities. Abdulmayin Hussein Aliazan contacted Mossad through the U.S. Embassy's economic attaché and worked for the CIA shell company Lapis until 2018. Hisham Ahmad Ali al-Wazir passed information to the CIA since 2009, monitoring activities aimed at dismantling national armaments under U.S. aid projects and providing political, economic and military information to the Americans. Mohammad Salah al-Kharashi was hired by the FBI in 2011 and provided a database and maps of camps, weapons depots, security centers, hospitals, roads, and routes. Other spies transmitted information that contributed to the American siege policy against Yemen and managed informant cells conducting espionage activities inside the country. The U.S. and its allies fully backed Saudi Arabia after it launched a no-holds-barred war against Yemen in March of 2015, sending advanced weaponry to Saudi Arabia. This war killed over 150,000 people, mostly innocent civilians, and created one of the world's worst humanitarian disasters, the effects of which are still visible. Western governments extended political and logistical support to Riyadh in their unsuccessful bid to restore power to Yemen's former government led by Abdurrahb Mansour Hadi. As quoted by Al Masira television network, Yemeni Major General Jalal Ali bin al-Ruwayshan said, "Today's achievement sends a message to the Americans and Israelis that Yemen is steadfast and determined in its victory for the cause of the nation, foremost of which is the Palestinian cause."
Choose to think better. Welcome to a better you. IRIB English Radio. Visit us at parstoday.ir/en.
Midstream.
Years after every internal event or presidential election, the West, its allies and agents in the region and beyond have bet on the future of the Iranian Islamic Revolution, which has so far defied all internal and external calculations. This revolution has proven itself once again after the election of reformer Masoud Pezeshkian as president, demonstrating its ideological and political maturity despite all the dangers it has faced over the years. The message sent by President-elect Pezeshkian to Hezbollah Secretary General Sayyid Hassan Nasrallah, addressing him first even before taking office, aimed to show the entire world that the revolution remains steadfast and any bets against its principles are bound to fail now and always. President Pezeshkian's second message to the head of Hamas Political Bureau, Ismail Haniyeh, reaffirmed the unwavering stance of the Iranian Revolution in supporting the central cause for all Arabs and Muslims, which is Palestine. The phone calls between Syrian President Bashar al-Assad, Russian President Putin, and Chinese President Xi Jinping with President-elect Pezeshkian came to confirm the continuation of Tehran's strategic approach in its relations with its allies. Without them, Iran would have been in a tougher situation. And without Iran, they would have also been in a difficult position, especially at this stage facing complex and serious regional and international challenges due to the situation in Ukraine, the imperialist colonial Zionist conspiracy against the Palestinian people with their divine patience. As for Western diplomatic circles, they expect, even wish, for President Pezeshkian to open channels of dialogue with Washington and Western capitals, as he promised during the election campaign, aiming to return to the nuclear agreement. They suggest that Washington will require Pezeshkian to show some lukewarmness in Iran's relations with both Beijing and Moscow, forgetting that it was President Trump who withdrew from the nuclear agreement, not Tehran. It was Tehran that faced hostility from Washington because it resisted and thwarted the imperialist West's plans during the so-called Arab Spring years. If those plans had succeeded, Iran would have also found itself in an undesirable situation due to the conspiracies of the imperialist West and its allies in the region. Regardless of the speculation about Iran's future policies under its new president, one thing remains evident. Imperialist, colonial, and Zionist agendas persist in manipulating Arab and Islamic public opinion. These forces continue to sideline critical issues that have long been the primary source of suffering for the region's peoples. Meanwhile, Iran will continue to support the peoples of the region to attain full liberation from the fangs of imperialism and Zionist colonialism. Welcome to the Middle East Stream. I'm Marwa Osman. The state and government in Iran have proven that they operate within an institutional framework. What the regime strives for is a strong state with influence beyond its borders and the ability to adapt for its interests. But will President Pezeshkian bring about radical changes? To discuss this issue with us from Tehran is Mr. Tara Sadiqi, political commentator and co-host of Twice Told Tales podcast. Thank you very much for being with us, Ms. Satara. Now, amidst regional conflict and political upheaval, Iran's political system has demonstrated stability by actually electing President Pezeshkian. But the main question asked everywhere, especially on hostile Western mainstream media, is are there any radical changes with Iranian President Pezeshkian taking power?
Thanks for having me. As you mentioned, Iran has been very stable in the stability during even the things that happened after the passing away of our president, our foreign minister, and the other officials shows that Iran has a strong political system that does not that is not affected easily by the events in the not only in the region but also in the country. I think for any country that has a strongly established system does not witness radical changes when the heads of the governments change, because there is a framework, there is a basis, a foundation, a strong foundation that the executive powers as well as the other branches of the power work within that frame and based on that foundation. So while certain things are going to be very different with regards to both foreign policy and domestic policy, we're not going to see radical changes because Iran is a stable country with a very well-established political system. And, you know, we had a snap election. We lost our president, our foreign minister. This was chaos enough for many countries to go through. But for Iran, we had a very peaceful transition of power, and which is still going on. And we had we held our elections for two different rounds. And the country elected their new president.
Mm-hmm. Well, Mr. Sattari, we did see that Mr. President Pezeshkian reaffirming the strong stance of the Islamic Republic of Iran beside regional resistance factions, namely Hezbollah and Hamas, which really is the very big concern for the West right here. They want to support both Hamas and Hezbollah in their fight against Zionist Israel, and they want to stick to that support. Did the Iranian public ever doubt during this transitional period that this will be the case with the soon adopted foreign policy, that they will shift maybe, or that they knew that their government will just stick to its foreign policy?
Well, the majority of the people know that this is one of the main principles of Iran's foreign policy, and the Iran's support for resistance will never be wavered. It's going to continue no matter who becomes the president, because all these presidents believe on those principles that the country upholds. So I think the majority of people knew, and there were no doubts about it, but their concerns may be about how the new president is going to establish alliances and relations with the other countries in the region that would, in a way, affect Iran's support for the resistant groups. But whether or not Iran would continue to support the resistant groups was never a question. And mm-hmm. That's a given fact that we all know about Iran's foreign policy.
I think the main issue was that President Pezeshkian is a reformist, and we did see many, he's the third reformist president, if I'm not mistaken, and we did see reformist presidents before him who continued to support. Nonetheless, even the support was greater at some point, militarily I speak, because it was during the years of the global war in Syria. So in that particular case, is there public support for it, or some people would like to see less of that support?
This is what the majority of the people want, because it's not only that we're offering support for another country of our, which is our friend. It's also a part of Iran's national security. Israel is not a threat only to those resistant groups and the countries of the region, but also a big threat to Iran's national security. And I mean, it tries to be, at least. And we see that as a form of repelling the threats by Israel. I mean, Israel has been trying to create chaos and attack and assassinate, and there's a long list and record of hostility towards Iran, and Iran's alliance with the regional countries and support for resistant groups is just part of that. The people want to stay, and that's a part of our national security that people want to see continued.
Mm-hmm. Well, with Mr. Masoud Pezeshkian's presidency, what do you think are the prospects and challenges of for the Islamic Republic of Iran in potentially maybe trying to return to the JCPOA nuclear agreement? I mean, how might this administration approach negotiations with the international community in the event Trump again is to become a president, and he's the one who actually withdrew from the JCPOA to begin with? If he's back in the White House, what kind of strategy does President Pezeshkian has to approach this negotiation?
Well, when Mr. Pezeshkian was the member of parliament, in a speech at the parliament, he mentioned that we cannot expect the U.S. to return, and we cannot trust the U.S. because it has once violated and breached its commitments to the deal. But during the campaigns, and that's what Iran has been doing, he mentioned that we need to find a way and work towards removing the sanctions in order to bring some economic ease to the country, because as that's the answer to your question with regards to what are the main challenges. One of the main challenges of the Islamic Republic right now and the new president is solving the economic issues and problems that the country is going through. And as a part of working towards that, Mr. Pezeshkian suggested that he's going to work towards removing the, getting the deal and returning to the JCPOA and removing the sanctions. However, we need to know that right now and for the past months, there is a negotiation team by late President Mr. Raisi that has been working on confidential negotiations through Oman to see how or if it's possible for the U.S. to return to the deal. And they're working with the other European and with China and Russia, the now formerly 5+1, but now 4+1 group. They're working to see what is the mechanism, what are the procedures to revive the JCPOA. But to be honest, it looks like the U.S. has no intention and is dragging its feet. So this is going to be a main challenge, reviving the JCPOA without the U.S. And making sure that the European partners will actually stay or abide by their commitments, because they also failed. I mean, the U.S. withdrew, but the European partners of the deal also failed to abide by their commitments. So this is going to be a main challenge of the foreign policy, especially that has been promised to the people that he's going to work towards that, and that's going to bring about some major changes in the economic situation of the country.
In 1 minute, if that doesn't work, what other plan does Mr. Pezeshkian have?
Well, I think by now, because we have the experience of trying to reach a deal in the first place, and then seeing Trump withdrawing from the U.S. withdrawing from the deal, now the president-elect has a more like he's relying more on domestic capabilities and on forming alliances with other countries. That's also what he has mentioned, that he's not going to focus on only forming alliances or reaching a deal with the West. He's going to work with Eastern partners and partners from the global South to see how it could help with developing Iran's economy and bringing about more economic ease.
Well, Sitara Sadiqi, political commentator and co-host of Twice Told Tales podcast, thanks a million for being with us to explain how things are going after the election of the new president, Mr. Pezeshkian. Ladies and gents, stay tuned, because next we will be talking about the shattered Zionist economy.
This is Midstream, and here is IRIB English Radio. Dear listeners, in this weekly program, Marvo Osman discusses two important issues related to West Asia region with two political analysts. Midstream is with you every Friday on IRIB English Radio.
Thousand Israeli businesses have been forced to shut as a result of the ongoing war and its devastating effect on the economy. Hebrew newspaper Maariv reported on 10th of July, referring to Zionist Israel as a country in collapse. More details in the following report.
Since the genocidal war in Gaza began, thousands of businesses have shut down in Zionist Israel, intensifying the economic crisis in the occupation entity. Zionist Israeli Kofas BDI, a company specializing in business information and credit risk management, reports that since October 7, 46,000 Israeli entity businesses have closed their doors. Yoel Amir, CEO of Kofas BDI, explained to Maariv, a Zionist daily newspaper, that this high number spans many sectors. About 77% of these closures, roughly 35,000 businesses, are small enterprises with up to 5 employees. According to Kofas BDI's risk rating, widely used by companies in the Israeli entity economy, including the banking system and international credit insurance companies, the construction industry and its ecosystem, ceramics, air conditioning, aluminum, and building materials are the most vulnerable. The report estimates that by the end of 2024, around 60,000 businesses in Zionist Israel may close. The crate sector, encompassing fashion, footwear, furniture, housewares, and services like cafes, entertainment, leisure, and transportation, has been hit hard. Additionally, the tourism industry is suffering from almost no foreign visitors, worsened by declining national morale and tourist areas now resembling combat zones. The agriculture sector, predominantly located in confrontation areas in the south and north, also faces manpower shortages. The economic damage is extensive. When companies shut down and fail to meet their financial obligations, the effects ripple out to impact customers, suppliers, and others within their ecosystem. Since the beginning of 2024, the Israeli regime's budget has recorded a cumulative deficit of 26 billion shekels, equivalent to about $7 billion. According to Maariv, the monthly budget deficit in March alone reached 15 billion shekels, or about $4 billion U.S. dollars, equating to 6.2% of the GDP. Moreover, the war has pushed Zionist Israel's debt to record levels since October 2023, reaching $43 billion U.S. dollars by April 2024, a figure that has doubled according to the Ministry of Finance of the entity. According to the data released by the Bank of Israel in late April 2024, Zionist Israel's war on the Gaza Strip has cost the occupation at least $67 billion so far. To discuss this issue with us from Beirut is Dr. Hassan Younes. He is an expert in economy, specialized in international business management, educational administration, and educational leadership. Thanks a million for being with us, Dr. Younes. Now, how does the closure of 46,000 businesses since the beginning of the war impact the long-term economic stability of Zionist Israel?
Yep. Thanks a lot for hosting me, Dr. Marwa. Actually, when we talk about the genocidal Israeli war on Gaza, we can't only take the aspect of what's happening in the battlefield or the military aspect. There is a war of narratives, and the resistance movements are having the upper hand in the war of narratives. The Israeli movements are having the upper hand in the military field, and apparently the resistance movements are having the upper hand from an economic perspective. Mm-hmm. What's happening in Israel is definitely an economic collapse. We have witnessed a slow growth in the economy. There are 46 businesses closing. The number is expected to grow to reach 60,000 businesses by the end of the year. This has a great impact on all the economic indications in the country, talking about inflation, recession, talking about the ability of the Israeli regime to attract capital. We are witnessing capital flight because the appetite of the international donors is decreasing. The credit worthiness of Israel or the Israeli entity is diminishing to a record level. The ranking of the Israeli economy has an impact on its credit worthiness. And the 46 businesses which are closing are from different sectors, mm-hmm. from all the sectors that you can imagine. And mostly they are small and medium enterprises. And these SMEs or small and medium enterprises, they are the backbone of any economy. Entrepreneurs are not investing in Israel. And the big donors are not sending enough capital to Israel. And if they are sending these gifts or donations are not invested in the right sectors. They are invested in immediate relief and not in infrastructural projects which are highly needed in Israel. And they are only for expenditure purposes and not for reinvesting purposes. Mm-hmm. These indicators are very negative in any economy. They are the indicators of developing countries rather than developed countries. And Israel always claims to be a developed country. Mm-hmm. So we're talking about business closures. We are talking about diversion of governmental spending. We are talking about decrease in the foreign investment, mm-hmm. the hesitancy of the developed countries to invest in Israel. Definitely they are hesitant because of this war. Usually when we talk about any organization, and I perceive a country or an entity as an organization, we usually talk about the goodwill. Israel is witnessing an unprecedented ill will. This ill will is due to the bad reputation. In addition to the military aspect, the bad reputation due to the war of narratives decreases the appetite of investment and decreases the propensity of the major countries to invest or send money to Israel.
Something quite interesting, Dr. Yunus, is that the substantial war expenditure has significantly increased Zionist Israel's debt, reaching record levels with a $67 billion U.S. dollar war expenditure so far. How do you think that that will be translated on Zionist Israel's internal fiscal health and probably also international credit standing?
So the impact of this number, the $67 billion, is not only the $67 billion, which is huge and which is unprecedented. The problem is in the credit ranking or credit rating. Israel will face difficulties in getting credits or getting gifts or getting donations in the future. And even if they want to borrow money, the propensity of the international organizations to lend Israel money will decrease substantially due to this problem in credit rating. These economic problems, in addition to the military problems they are facing, have an impact on different levels. For instance, around the number of expected tourists to Israel was supposed to be 1 million. And they've received only 200,000 tourists. So a substantial decrease in 80%. And usually such countries rely on the expenditures of tourists to give an injection to the economy. In the contrary, these numbers, we're not witnessing them in Lebanon. The number of tourists in Lebanon and the number of the Lebanese, the diaspora, coming back to Lebanon
actually,
is increasing substantially.
Far more, it's increasing than the years before.
It's increasing substantially. So when I want to compare figures from the different aspects, military, economically, tourists-wise, narratives-wise, the upper hand is always being to the resistance movements, as you can see, Maro.
Well, Dr. Yunus, trade and tourism, as you were mentioning, are essential for foreign exchange, for international relations. But could their downturn, these two sectors, the downturn of these sectors, diminish Zionist Israel's economic influence and maybe attractiveness as a destination for business, for tourism? Or is it just temporary setback and maybe after the war it will pick up again?
To pick up again, you need to invest in the infrastructure. The damage is big, Marwa. The supply chains when we talk about economy, we can't talk about only one sector. The different sectors are impacted. The supply chain, the chain which links the distributors to the retailers, to the wholesalers, to the manufacturers, it's being impacted. In many cases, it's being destroyed. The recovery is not easy. It's on the long term, and it requires investments from the international community or from the developed countries. And the credit ranking, the diminish in the credit ranking, would make this more difficult, definitely. And as I've mentioned, the ill will of the reputation, the bad reputation, the reputational damage of Israel has decreased the appetite. The boycotting movements, which we've done, also will decrease the appetite of the international brands, of the major franchisers, to give the franchising agreements to Israel. So all these factors, accompanied with the decrease in tourism, with the lack of the injection of these foreign funds and foreign currencies in Israel, will also decrease the chances of recovery, or at least slow it down at an unprecedented figures.
Well, we think that this might be one of the consequences of starting a genocide, but that's just me saying. I want to thank you very much, Dr. Hassan Yunus, expert in economics, specialized in international business management, educational administration, and education leadership. It's always a pleasure seeing you and talking to you. Hopefully we talk when liberation happens and we start talking about how the economy of Palestine will pick up inshallah. Thanks a million for being with us. Ladies and gents, thank you. Please do stay tuned on the Middle East stream next week for more updates. Adhamallah ajrukum bi musab Aba Abdullah Hussein for the calamity that befell on Ahlul Bayt, the family of the Prophet, for the martyrdom of Imam Hussein in Karbala. Assalamu alaikum wa rahmatullah.
IRIB English Radio presents Viewpoints.
The presence of different scholars.
And God said, "Let there be light," and there was light.
The Creator made Adam in his image, then placed the world in his care. May you walk alongside the Creator in righteousness.
God of Abraham, take my child into thy hands, that he may live to thy service.
God has spoken to us before, through Abraham, Noah, Moses, and through Jesus Christ. Why should we be so surprised that God speaks to us now through Muhammad?
Viewpoint.
A critique of movies with religious themes on IRIB English Radio.
Bismillah ar-Rahman ar-Rahim, in the name of God, welcome to another edition of the program, Viewpoints, the movie critique program on RIB English Radio, with me, Muhammad Javad, hosting this program, and my two friends and critiques and guests, Sayyid Abdullah and Brother Yasser. Sayyid Abdullah, assalamu alaikum, and welcome to the program.
Wa alaikum assalam wa rahmatullahi wa barakatuh, and thank you for having me.
You're welcome. And Brother Yasser, assalamu alaikum and welcome to the studio.
Alaykum assalam wa rahmatullah wa barakatuh. Always a pleasure being with you.
The pleasure is always mine. You know, in these series of programs, we usually choose or decide on a movie and then we criticize it, usually based on its content, which is, somehow something to do with the religious or a spiritual theme. And we don't criticize movies for the sake of art or artistically speaking, like some of the other critical programs that are out there on the media. One of those movies that we've decided, in fact, to criticize is called I, Frankenstein, which is produced in 2014, directed by Stuart Biatty. Well, it features actors and actresses such as